Madam Chairman, friends, last week I was so preoccupied in shushing you that I did not pay the usual and meant respects to your chair lady. So let my greetings today be doubled. First to Mrs. Leo Newmark, secondly to Mrs. Norman Berman, for the very lovely way in which they've organized these programs and chaired them this last week and this week too. Now, let's get down to work. We spoke last week of the variety of literature which is included in the Bible, the variety of literature which is represented by the various biblical books, and the correspondingly different qualities of judgment and of criticism which each require. Today I'd like to begin by refining this statement a little further. For not only are there various separate books in the Bible, and not only do these books differ in style, in purpose, and the kind of literature represented, and not only are these various books written over a period of time reaching back into the second millennium before the Common Era, running down from there to the second century before the Common Era, a period of time twice as long as the entire skein of English literature from Beowulf to our own day. But each, or at least in most of the biblical books, are themselves composite, made up of differing strands or of chapters submitted by different men. Turn with me for a moment then to the book of Proverbs, to the first chapter of the book of Proverbs. I hope you've learned since last week how to find your place in the Bible. Did you all memorize the books of the Bible so you could flip through and find them? Now notice that the book of Proverbs begins with a verse which tells us its presumed authorship. The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. And after that we get the list of the sayings which are attributed to the wisest of all of Israel's kings, Solomon. Now flip over to chapter 29 of the book of Proverbs. Chapter 30, rather. And you notice the first verse, the words of Agur, the son of Jaca, the burden. Now we have no idea who Agur, the son of Jaca, was, but he certainly wasn't Solomon. What we have here in this chapter is a tied-on set of proverbs ascribed to some other man. Tied on is not a metaphor, but a quite literal use of the English language. Because you remember that we're dealing not with books, but with scrolls. And the way in which scrolls were put together was to take the hide of the goat or of the sheep, dry it, write on it, tie it together with the next hide, write on that, and add a third. So the means of conflation or of addition was simply to tie on one scroll to the next. Now flip to the next chapter, chapter 31. And we find another author. The words of King Lemuel, the burden wherewith his mother corrected him. King Lemuel had many of the problems we still have today. But in any case, these are his particular thoughts, and they include that magnificent poem in praise of womankind, which you all know, a woman of valor, who can find. Those of you who have the Jewish Publication Society Bible, and this is simply an aside, will notice that beginning on verse 10 in chapter 31, the Hebrew alphabet is printed down on the left-hand side of each succeeding verse. This is a separate poem, these last 21 verses, known as an acrostic. Each line begins with the succeeding letter in the Hebrew alphabet. It really makes no point in an English translation to print them this way, but this is simply an indication to you of the kind of poetry involved. My point is simply this, that in the book of Proverbs, we have the work of at least three different writers. Two of them are utterly unknown to us. We have no idea of the time and place of the actual writing. Why were these little additions added? Possibly for very practical reasons. A small scroll tends to disappear and to get lost. They may have simply been trying to preserve originally the words of Agur and of Lemuel. More probably, they wanted to include these words in the Bible. But the Bible was not about to canonize three books of rather common sense and prosaic wisdom. So they simply made them into one book, and we now have them. How do we know that the Bible was not, the editors of the Bible were not about to canonize three different books of this kind? Well, there's a much better book of Proverbs than the biblical book of Proverbs. It's called The Wisdom of Ben Sirach. It was written in the second century before the Common Era by a merchant philosopher from Jerusalem. It's a long book. It's sharp, perceptive. In style, I think it's superior to the biblical book of Proverbs, which had, however, the virtue of a hoary antiquity of having been ascribed to King Solomon. They didn't want to put in two books of this kind of wisdom. They chose the book of Proverbs, and the book of the wisdom of Ben Sirach was kept in the Apocrypha, in the books which were not included. My point then, to repeat, each biblical book may be a composite of a variety of works. This is true also of the biblical book of Psalms. There are 150 Psalms in this anthology. Some of them are titled the Psalm of David, ascribed by tradition to King David. Some of them are ascribed to the sons of Korach. Some of them are ascribed directly to a man named Asaph. Others are anonymous. And what they did was simply to draw together the spiritual literature, the hymns sung in the ancient temple, the liturgy of Jerusalem, and they bound them together in this little book of Psalms. And interestingly, we've now found a 151st psalm, a psalm that somehow got lost. In the literature found in the Dead Sea caves, they found a scroll of the book of Psalms, which include a psalm which is not in our Bible. Either the string got unraveled, or somehow we got a copy of a scroll which did not include this particular psalm. So things have been lost in transmission. There are omissions in the Bible, and things were added in the process of transmission. Now, if this were all, if all we had to do was to look for the superscription, a Psalm of David, a Psalm of Korach, the Proverbs of Lemuel, our task, our interpretive task, would be a relatively simple one. But all too often, the Bible does not give us such clear signals as to composite authorship. And we have to resort to our own powers of logic and discrimination and reason. Now, since most of us are a little bit bleary-eyed this morning, we spent last night watching political things. Let me give you an illustration from the Bible in the realm of political theory. I must first give you some background so that you understand these two chapters. In the 11th century before the Common Era, and in the century before that, our fathers came out of this area of the Transjordan Desert, and they moved across the Jordan River and settled in the highlands and then in the farming lands of Canaan. They hardly had a chance to settle on the land when a new threat came at them from an unexpected direction. A sea people attacked Canaan, the Philistines. They are believed to have originally come from Crete. They are known to have attacked Egypt in the 11th century before the Common Era. They were repulsed by Egypt. and they moved up the coast to Ashkelon, Ashdod, and these other cities which are now in the southwestern sea coast area of Israel. They settled there, they raised the cities, they built their own, and then they began to expand inland. They were a powerful people, an advanced civilization, an excellent military folk. Now, Israel had originally been ruled as a loose tribal league. Each of the tribes had its own tribal council. Government was done by meeting of the chieftains. The tribes came together only in time of danger. And then they elected a man who was called a shofet. We translate it judge, but judge in the English language is a misleading translation. The judge was a general. He was a general whose brevet, whose commission of office, was good only for the period of the emergency. Once the raiders had been repulsed, he lost his power. He became only one of the council of one of the tribes, and the tribes went back into their own states' rights way. Now, as the Philistines began to encroach more and more and with greater and greater military success against Canaan, against our forefathers, it was apparent that they needed some kind of centralized military authority. They needed, in other words, centralized government, and the only form of centralized government which was known was a king. And pressure was brought to have such a king empowered. Now, if you will, turn to the first book of Samuel, chapter 9. And if you turn to verse 15, we read there one account of the empowering of the first king, who was Saul, of course, in Israel. You all got the place? You haven't got your glasses. That's a problem. Can these help? Now the Lord had revealed unto Samuel a day before Saul came, saying, "Tomorrow about this time I will send thee a man out of the land of Benjamin, and thou shalt anoint him to be prince over my people Israel, and he shall save my people out of the hand of the Philistines. For I have looked upon my people, because their cry is come unto me." And when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord spoke unto him, "Behold the man of whom I said unto thee, this same shall have authority over my people." Now, in these very few verses, we have a very direct statement. God wills the kingship. Samuel, who is the religious authority, chooses the man at God's will who is to be king. The king is mandated, and he is an utterly legitimate source of authority. We have, in other words, the basis of monarchy in these few chapters, few verses. Now turn to chapter 8, the chapter which immediately precedes. 1 Samuel chapter 8. I'd like to read this whole chapter with you because it's a very crucial one in the development of our religious thought. "And it came to pass, when Samuel was old, that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second Abiah, and they were judges in Beersheba. And his sons walked not in his way, but turned aside after lucre, and took bribes, and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together, and came to Samuel unto Ramah, and they said unto him, 'Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations.' But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, 'Give us a king to judge us.' And Samuel prayed unto the Lord. And the Lord said unto Samuel, 'Hearken unto the voice of the people and all that they say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should be king over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even unto this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto thee. Now therefore hearken unto their voice, howbeit thou shalt earnestly forewarn them, and shalt declare unto them the manner of the king that shall reign over them.' And Samuel told all the words of the Lord unto the people that asked of him a king. And he said, This will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons, and he will appoint them unto him for his chariots, to be his horsemen, and they shall run before his chariots. There'll be conscription. And he will appoint them unto him for captains of thousands and captains of 50, and to plow his ground, and to reap his harvest, and to make his instruments of war, and the instruments of his chariots. Man will no longer be master of his own destiny. And you will take your daughters to be perfumers, and to be cooks, and to be bakers. You'll have a harem and a court, and your daughters will all have to be courtesans. And you will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his service. There'll be expropriation. And you will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. He'll have to reward his favorites, and he will have to reward from that which is yours. And you will take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to his work. And you will take a tenth of your flock, and ye shall be his servants. And ye shall cry out in that day because of your king whom you shall have chosen. And the Lord will not answer you in that day. But the people refused to hearken unto the voice of Samuel, and they said, Nay, but there shall be a king over us, that we may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he spoke them in the ears of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, Hearken unto their voice, and make them a king. And Samuel said unto the men of Israel, Go ye every man unto his city. Now here we have an utterly different account of the legitimacy of monarchy. It is illegitimate. Israel required a king not for a legitimate defensive purpose, but for no better reason than that everyone else had them. You have to keep up with the Joneses, or in this case with the Philistines and the Moabites and the Edomites. And Samuel is at great pains to make clear two things. First, that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And secondly, that God did not order the establishment of a royal monarchy. In fact, that God agreed to it only because he had already despaired of the faithfulness of Israel, and he knew them to be a wayward people. Now, these two chapters could not have been written by the same hand. They represent two diametrically opposed philosophies of government. They are tied together in the Bible in two succeeding chapters. But it is patently evident from their inner context that they are inconsistent. And then it is the job of the biblical scholar to try and put each into his own place. Chapter 9, the consensus has it, is earlier. It represents a need met. Saul was indeed appointed king. Saul faced the Philistines, and when he failed, David was appointed instead, and David had enough success and destroyed the Philistine menace. And it is an assumption by a royal house which has achieved power of the legitimacy of its power. It is assumed that the second chapter, which you read, is about 100 years later. David has enhanced his power, and Solomon has come along and has demanded more power yet. And Solomon, you'll remember, is the man of many wives, of many palaces, of great armies. And of course, all this excess, which is described in chapter 8, springs up, the scholars believe, as a protest against the oriental despotism which Solomon and some of the later kings established over Israel. Now, if you're going to make a theory of biblical political practice, which chapter do you rely upon? The whole Bible is sacred. You've got confusion. If you live in medieval ages when the kings have the divine right to rule badly, you take chapter 9. If you're in modern times, you take chapter 8. And you talk about the balance of power and the dangers of untrammeled power and the like. If your criteria is precedence, chapter 8 precedes chapter 9. If your criteria is relevance and truth, chapter 8 precedes chapter 9. But that's a judgment on fact. And that's why this concept that the whole Bible is sacred, or the idea that the Bible is somehow consistent, leads us into absolute confusion. Because the Bible often argues against itself. And we have here really a classic example. I could choose many others. I took this only because I too watched television last night. Now, what are our critical tools, then, to decide as to the various strands and layers of the Bible? First is inconsistency of treatment. The second is inconsistency of philosophy, repetition, repetitiousness. And finally, we know Hebrew, questions of style and language and form. Now, we must do this separating out of various parts of the Bible as carefully as we can. That ancient documents are put together in this rather haphazard way has long been known. The ancients didn't use the quotation mark and footnote reference and copyright regulations the same way we did. But for a long time, the sacredness of this book, the idea that it was holy, that it was sacrosanct and taboo, kept people, for the most part, from treating the Bible critically. Oh, they began to recognize already in the Middle Ages that the author of the last chapters of Isaiah could not be the same man who wrote the first chapters. The burden of the first chapters can be simply put, the anger of the Lord is kindled against his people. It's a bitter book, a denunciatory book. Chapter 40 begins, comfort ye, my people. Bid Jerusalem take heart and proclaim unto her that her time of service is accomplished, her guilt is paid off. In the first Isaiah, the guilt has hardly begun to be penalized. In the second Isaiah, we call now the Deutro Isaiah, the guilt has been paid off and the people must be brought back to their land. So we have to use concepts of content. We have to analyze the subject matter and try to understand what it means. With the five books of Moses, and I'm gradually narrowing in on the subject matter I want to lay bare before you this morning. In the five books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, men held off applying the critical standards, this standard of composite authorship, until very late. Why? Because there was the ancient piety that these five books had all been given by God to Moses in the desert at or near Mount Sinai and during the wilderness wanderings. Now, where did this piety begin? In this case, the Bible itself is to blame. Turn to chapter 31, if you will, in the book of Deuteronomy. The fourth last chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. We're doing a lot of moving around between books and pages, but it's a good way to learn how to use the Bible, and that's why we're here. This is Moses' valedictory. He's been told by God he must die. He will not cross into the promised land, and he summons the family together at the bedside, and he gives his last will and testament. And Moses went and spoke these words unto all Israel, and he said unto them, I am 120 years old this day. I can no more go out and come in. And the Lord hath said unto me, thou shalt not go over this Jordan. Go out and come in, by the way, is an idiom meaning to lead out in battle. The Lord thy God, he will go over before thee. He will destroy these nations from before thee, and thou shalt dispossess them. And Joshua, he shall go over before thee as the Lord has spoken. And then moving to verse 7, and Moses called unto Joshua and said unto him in the sight of all Israel, be strong and of good courage, for thou shalt go with this people into the land which the Lord hath sworn unto their fathers to give them, and thou shalt cause them to inherit it. And the Lord, he it is that doth good before thee. He will be with thee. He will not fail thee, neither forsake thee. Fear not, neither be dismayed. And Moses wrote this law and delivered it unto the priests, the sons of Levi, that bore the ark of the covenant of the Lord, and to all the elders of Israel. And Moses wrote this law. Now, the Hebrew word here for law is Torah. And Torah, as you know, has come to mean the entire five books of Moses in our ark. As a matter of fact, it tends to mean the entire Bible itself. Piety had it that the Torah was the entirety of Scripture. Actually, Torah in the Bible does not mean the scroll in an ark. It means simply a law. An apodictic law, a law given, thus saith the Lord, thou shalt not murder. Thus saith the Lord, thou shalt not kill. That's a Torah. It's a statement, a law, a divine fiat. This chapter means no more than this. And Moses wrote this law. What law? Verse 10 tells us, at the end of every 7 years, in the set time of the year of release, in the feast of the tabernacles, when all Israel is come to appear before the Lord thy God, assemble the people, thou shalt read this law before all Israel in their hearing. In other words, at Sukkot's time, the leaders from then on were to read the law, the basic constitution of Israel, before the people. But because of this slippery meaning to the word Torah, the piety grew up that the entire 5 books of Moses were in fact of Mosaic, which means of divine authorship. Well, if this be true, we have troubles. What do we do, for instance, with the last chapter of Deuteronomy? Turn to it. It's chapter 34. And Moses went up from the plains of Moab unto Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah that is over against Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land, even Gilead as far as Dan, and all Naphtali, the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, and all the land of Judah as far as the Hinder Sea, that's the Mediterranean, and the south and the plain, and so on. And the Lord said unto him, this is the land which I swore unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob, saying, I will give it unto thy seed. I have caused thee to see it with thine eyes, but thou shalt not go over thither. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. He was buried in the valley in the land of Moab, over against Beth Peor, and no man knoweth of his sepulcher unto this day. How can a man write about his own death? How can a man describe a yet unchosen place of burial? And most of all, how can a man say, and no man knoweth of his grave unto this day? What's this day? How would Moses have written this? This mystery is called the mystery of the 12. It's a classic of biblical criticism. And as early as the Talmud, 1,500 years ago, our rabbis said that Moses wrote the entire law, excepting for this last chapter, which was written by Joshua. It had that piety and was tied into the book of Deuteronomy simply out of respect for a good story completely told. The story of Moses in Deuteronomy would not be complete until we had his death. But that's evading the issue, because it is in the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy, the piety claims, is entirely revealed. This patently cannot be. In the 12th century of the Common Era, a Jewish scholar, Abraham Ibn Ezra, went through the 5 books of Moses, and he pointed out a number of verses like this verse, and no man knoweth of his sepulcher unto this day, which gave him pause. And though he was afraid to come out directly and say that he doubted the divine authorship of these 5 books, he alluded to it. Now let's see how good you are as biblical critics. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 1. These are the words which Moses spoke unto all Israel beyond the Jordan, in the wilderness, in the Arava, over against Suf, between Paran and Tophel and Mabam and Hasrot and Dizahav. Why could Moses not have written that? What? Over the Jordan, exactly. Over the Jordan would imply for Moses, who never crossed the Jordan, Palestine. But the text is talking about places that are trans-Jordan. We have an obvious inconsistency here. If Moses had written this, he would have had to have been in Canaan. But the Bible tells us directly he was on the other side of the Jordan. There are about 15 such classic illustrations of inconsistencies within the text itself. Now, the work of unsticking the parts is the subject of many variables, great scholarship. We have yards and yards of books on our shelves in the library which are attempting to separate out the various strands. 100 years ago, German scholars who were the first to work at this thought they had the job completed. And with usual German efficiency, they printed what they called polyglot Bibles. These were Bibles printed with various colored type. The yellow meant that it was an author from a certain century, the blue from another century, the red from another one. And there were very few words and phrases in the Torah which could not be given a specific color. In the last 100 years, largely because of the advances in the studies of linguistics, because we've learned more and more about what words meant 2,000 and more years ago, and because of the study of archaeology, we have become less and less sure of what they were sure about. We have tended to date back what they dated late. We have tended to see historical truth where they saw only myth. We have tended to understand the Bible far better. But what remains clear, and what cannot be gainsaid this late in the game, is that the 5 books of Moses are made up of a number of separate strands. That means that they are a compilation of a number of separate traditions, some reaching back to the 12th and 13th centuries BC, some perhaps as late as the 5th, perhaps the 6th century BC. And these various traditions have signet and signatures. You can tell differences in style. You can tell differences in language. The classic difference is in the name of God. In one of the oldest and one of the most complete of the versions of which the Bible is made up, God is always referred as Adonai, or with that awkwardness that modern German scholars love, Yahweh. There never was such a God as Yahweh. This is a creation of the gymnasium. But there is, in the Bible, this Hebrew word, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. This is a word which was never pronounced. It was called the ineffable name of God. It comes from the root to be. It means simply that which is, the pure essence. It had a magical quality to it. I mean, let's not get around that. But it was not pronounced. And what they did, they put some vowels under it, like that, and they made it say Jehovah, and then they printed this abomination, which you see, like this, or put A's in it, Yahweh, and that became an archaism, which meant somehow that our God wasn't God, and it was something way back when. Now, this earliest strand uses Adonai. And whenever you tend to find Adonai in the text in Hebrew, you can recognize that this is probably that strand. Another strand, which is almost as old, but not quite, uses the name Elohim, which also means God. Now, why one strand should have used Adonai and one strand should have used Elohim, we don't know. It may have been that one was a familiar form in the northern Israelite tribes, another was a familiar form in the Judean tribe. But these are signatures, stylistic signatures, which help us in the interpretation. What am I getting at? I'm getting to the point where we were at last week, that you cannot assume the antiquity of chapters in the Bible simply because of their placement in the Bible. And this is, by the way, no modern chokmah. The rabbinic tradition already knew of the principle, Ein mukdam umuchar batorah. There's no chronological principle of placement of chapters in the Torah. And so that the Genesis 1, as I said last week, is very late. Some of the earliest chapters in the Bible, parts of the Bible, appear in Joshua and Judges and elsewhere. Well then, Rabbi, what are the earliest sections in the Bible? The earliest sections in the Bible appear here and there. They're little snippets of verse. People wrote poetry before they wrote prose. Why? Because they didn't write. They recited. And poetry is far easier to remember than prose. In the ancient tribes, each tribe had its rememberer, a man who remembered the traditions of the tribe in a poetic form, and who would sit before the tribal council and at various holy days, shuckle back and forward. Everybody knows what shuckling is, don't they? You know, you chant, you move backwards and forwards. And they chanted because this was the movement of the camel on the desert. And often he would go before the camel troops and recite the war songs and the valorous history of the heroics of the tribe. And he would recite these ancient tribal liturgies. Some of them were war chants. Some of them were lamentations for dead heroes. Some of them were wedding poems. Some of them helped the tribe to remember its pasture land, the wells that belonged to it, the places it was allowed to visit and to move, the places where it could not go. I'll give you only one example of a very early portion of the Bible, Numbers chapter 21. If you turn to verse 16, this is a geographical description of certain places the tribes were wandering in the desert. And from thence to Be'er, which simply means a well, it is the well, whereof the Lord said unto Moses, gather the people together, and I will give them water. Then Israel sang this song, spring up, O well, sing ye unto it. The well which the chieftains dug, which the nobles of the people started with maces and with their own staffs. That's it. It's a short ditty. We believe it to have been written originally to give the location of the well by the placement of certain words in the text. It's very old. It antedates Moses. It goes back into the patriarchal period, into the wanderings. And you have little bits of verse here and there. They're very difficult to understand. Men are just beginning to understand the principle of Semitic poetry. But these are the oldest of the portions of the Bible. All this is to get you to some of the later portions of the Bible, which come first, and to disabuse your minds once and for all of their earliness. Genesis 1 through 11. This is what we're going to deal with today. The first 11 chapters of Genesis are the great books of beginning, the cosmic myths, the story of origins, creation, Adam and Eve, the Garden of Eden, the Tree of Life, the Forbidden Fruit, Cain and Abel, the two brothers who squabbled, the first murder, Noah and the flood, the ark, the animals two by two, which your children so love, and the story, of course, of the Tower of Babel. Now, these stories have been usually interpreted as part of the innocence of the race, as among the early things, the juvenile things, the childhood things. They are, in fact, late. And we won't appreciate them unless we really understand that they are cultivated, heavily theological, serious-minded, and philosophic. They are anything but naive folk tales told way back when, at the beginning of time. Genesis 1, which we touched on last week, is something far more than bad science. If you assume the early writing of Genesis 1, it seems to be nothing more than an accurate description of the creation of the world. When you realize its lateness, it's one of the latest chapters in the Bible. You realize it does many things. It establishes the philosophic principle that God is the creator. It establishes the philosophic principle, which was revolutionary in that day, that life is good. You know the refrain, and behold, it was good, that life is good and the world is to be enjoyed and life on earth is to be made the most of. It establishes the principle that man and woman were created somehow in the image of God, that there's a spiritual thing within us. An élan, which is godlike, conscience, or the capacity to feel, or mind. It establishes a man is made dominant over the other animals of the world, and these are to be cultivated, and these are to be husbanded for man's specific purpose. And finally, it establishes the fact that the seventh day is a mandatory day of rest in which you may not work your slave labor, your animal, or the like. Now this is the philosophic matrix of Genesis 1. It was written to underscore and to establish all of these purposes. Jewish history, let me make this point a little bit differently. Jewish history, the Bible, really begins with Genesis 12. with Abraham. Abraham is not only the legendary first Jew, but the Jews themselves believe that their history began with Abraham. How do we know this? We know this from the Bible itself. There is told in Deuteronomy 26, and we didn't turn to it. Deuteronomy 26 tells us that when our ancestors came to Jerusalem on Sukkot, and they brought there the fruits of their harvest, they recited an ancient formula. And what did this formula say? My father was a wandering Aramean, and he left off his home, and he went to search a new land, and he came to the worship of God, and God promised him settlement in the promised land, and now we too, members of that covenant of Abraham, are allowed to enjoy the bounty of this good earth, the land flowing with milk and with honey. Now this is one of the ancient liturgical formulas of our people, and it's revealing in that it insists that Jewish history begins with Abraham. Why then the first 11 chapters? The answer is a simple one. It's a matter of cultural conditioning. All the peoples of this entire Near Eastern area, in the Mesopotamian area, the watersheds of the Tigris and the Euphrates, began their histories by going back to creation and telling the history of the world down to their progenitors. And the framework which the early writers used, a creation story, 10 generations of primordial kings between creation and the flood, a flood story, and then some generations since the flood to the progenitor of the tribe, is a classic form which is known from Sumerian and Akkadian and Assyrian and Babylonian mythology and writings, and is uniform, universal, in the literature of the Middle East. They all then had these myths of beginning. What is crucial is to see how the myths of beginning of our people were different, if they were. Now, since Mr. Freud and some of the men who have gone about delving into the subconscious, men have tended to take the literary forms of myth and to assume these to have been the earliest forms. What we find when we deal with the Bible is that almost all of the crudeness and the violence and the vulgarity and the sexuality of early myths has been purged. Not completely. We still have Cain and Abel. But I'll show you, I hope, as we go along, how we have vacuum cleaned these ancient myths and fumigated them and made them serve a more spiritual purpose. Now, I don't propose to read Genesis 1. We know it too well. But I would like to read to you Genesis 1 as it was known in Babylon in the 6th century before the Common Era by the greatest empire of the world then. Great god of the Babylonians, the head of their pantheon was a god named Marduk. This is the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar and Nebuchadnezzar and the great hanging gardens of Babylon, one of the great wonders of the world. This is the kingdom that defeated the Assyrians. And this is a kingdom which lived some 300-400 years, perhaps, after Genesis as we know it was written. Now their Genesis epic is called Emunah Elish. And let me read just a few paragraphs from it to you. Notice, first of all, it is pantheistic. Secondly, it is polytheistic. It tends to see force in nature and tends to see many gods in the world. When the heaven gods above were as yet uncreated, and the earth gods below not yet brought into being, alone there existed primordial Apsu, that's a god like Cosmos in the Greeks, who engendered them. Only the gods Mumu and Tiamat, who brought all of them forth. Their waters could mix together in a single stream, unrestricted by reed beds, unimpeded by marsh. For since none of the gods at this time appeared, these had not yet been formed or been with destinies decreed. In the depths of their waters, the gods were created. There appeared Lachmu and Lachamu. They first were given name. But only to an appointed size did they grow and become larger. But Anshar and Kishar were born bigger than they. As lengthened the days and there multiplied the years, Anshar and Likeside produced Anu, his firstborn. As Anu, their son, was the equal of his parents, so did Anu begat Ea in the likeness of himself. Ea is the great mother goddess. Now, what do we have? We have simply an evolution of gods who themselves represent a cosmic structure of evolution. And what do we have in Genesis 1? We have first the cosmos, then the firmament, then the world itself. There are no spirits representing each of these worlds. The spirit world has been completely erased. And our forefathers were the only ones to see the world wholly naturalistically because they saw only one founding principle, only one creative force in the world. But there's another great difference between these common myths and our own. And that is what these men made of man himself. Man, according to the Bible, is created in the image of God, and the image of God created he him. Man is given dominance over the creatures of the world, and man is sent out to make the most of this great world of ours. Let's look at the Babylonian myth. As Marduk acknowledged this appeal of the gods, he decided to create another wonder of wonders. Opening his mouth, he spake forth to Ea, invited him to comment on the theory he proposed. This is Marduk's proposal. Blood will I compose, bring a skeleton into being, produce a lowly, primitive creature, man shall be his name. I will create Lulu Amelu, an earthly puppet man. To him be charged the service, that the gods may then have rest. Man is of low estate. Man is a puppet in the hands of God. Man's sole purpose is to be charged with the service, charged with ritual and rite, with the bringing of sacrifice, that the gods may be pleased and that their duties may be performed. Here again we have the evidence of an amazing religious revolution. Man in the Jewish tradition and alone in the Jewish tradition is a thing of some stature, thing of some dignity. And man's purpose on earth is not simply to bow in obeisance before the gods or to bring them the sacrifice, but man's purpose on earth is to establish the just kingdom of God here. And this vision of Genesis 1 presumes, first of all, of Isaiah, who said, I don't want your sacrifices in the name of God. Bring no more vain oblations. These are an abomination unto me. Your new moons and all the things that you bring. Why do you trample my courts? What do I demand of you? To do justice, to love righteousness, to establish justice in the gates and so on. This is the Jewish view, and it's remarkably reflected in Genesis 1. In sum, Genesis 1 is a creation myth. Genesis 1 is a creation myth within the forms known throughout the Near Eastern world. But it's a myth which has been radically changed. And there is no parallel in ancient times to the way in which we tell this myth. Why did we use a myth? Some of us who have outgrown the fairy story and who like everything in simple logical and scientific equations wonder, why did they resort to such a telling? Why couldn't they have come out and simply stated philosophy? Well, a myth is attractive, it gets interest. A myth is a way of teaching. When we look at the equations of the physical scientists of our day, most of us simply close the page in absolute confusion. We don't know where to begin. A myth drives science home, drives theology home. But I would remind you that the greatest of the inventors of science, the Greeks, told myth about the creation of the world. They reveled in the world of myth. And lest we feel that our ancestors were somehow archaic or naive, let me read to you one brief paragraph from the Greek myths which described the creation of the world, not from the earliest of the Greek myths, but from the Greek myths of the classic age of Athens, of Pericles and of Aeschylus, of Sophocles, of Plato, Socrates. Heaven and earth had been created. The sea ebbed and flowed between its shores, and the fish frolicked in the waters. In the air sang winged birds, and the earth swarmed with animals. But as yet there was no creature in whose body the spirit could house, and from there govern the world around it. Then down to earth came Prometheus, The name means in Greek forethought. Prometheus, a descendant of the ancient race of gods, which Zeus had dethroned. Now Prometheus was crafty and nimble-witted. He knew that the seed of heaven lay sleeping in the earth. So he scooped up some clay, moistened it with water from a river, kneaded it this way and that, and shaped it into the image of the gods, the lords of the world. To give life to this earth-formed figure, he took both good and evil from the core of many animals. He locked them in man's breast. He had a friend among the immortals, Athene, the goddess of wisdom, who marveled at what the son of the Titans had created, and she breathed the spirit, the divine spirit, into this creature, which as yet was only half alive. Now this is myth, pure myth. It's pregnant in meaning, rich in meaning. And as we read this myth, we can understand what Socrates meant when he said, the myth taken as a whole is false, but there is truth in it also. And I want you to know that when our ancestors wrote these first 11 chapters of Genesis, they knew that the history taken as a whole is false, but there is truth, deep truth in it also. They understood what Socrates meant. They used myth, and they were not at all disabused by it. Now, before we get to the actual reading of some of these myths, let me stop and try and answer the questions which I may have raised, and then we'll go on from here. Don't be shy. Yes. It's a good question. The question is simply this. How did we get this little calendar which says that we're in the year, what? 5,725. That year was so useful, I never remember it. The answer is that this dating is a very late one. The earliest calendar which we know in ancient Israel dated from the regnal years of kings. You dated it the third year of King Uzziah, the fourth year of King Solomon. And you dated each king's year by his ascension, his being anointed as king, which was done on one particular day of the year. Then we Jews began to date, as did all peoples in the ancient Near East, from the year 333 before the Common Era, which was a great year in which Alexander the Great completed his conquest of what was then the known world. This was called the Minyan Shtarot, the dating of contracts. And for about 1,000 years, this remained the classic dating among Jews. Then the Jews, who still lived mostly in the Near East and the African world, began to date, as did all the Muslims, from the Hegira, from 632 of the Common Era, when Muhammad fled from Mecca to Medina and established Islam. This is the classic date of the Islamic world. So therefore, we had no compunctions about using any and all calendar systems until we ran into the Christian world. And why did the Christian world's calendar give us a problem? Because it is dated not in terms of an historical event, but in terms of belief in a Christ. B.C. means before the Christ. A.D. Anno Domini, the year of our Lord. Both assume what is for the Jew an impossible theological assumption. And so in the Middle Ages, when our people moved into Europe in the great numbers, they had to devise a new calendar system. And in the Middle Ages, which were the Dark Ages among our peoples, among all others, they had to come up with a new system. Alexander the Great didn't mean anything. Muhammad was the great enemy of the Crusades. They couldn't still use that date. So somebody sat down and trying to figure out what was the date of the creation of the world from the Bible, and he came up with a certain date, and that's what the date that we still have on our calendars. I doubt that this date has been used for more than 600 years. Jewish history dates back 3,800 years, so for the better part of our history, we've used quite other calendars. And certainly no one in the Bible knew of this date. Will you stand? If I can't see your lips, I have problems hearing. Seven is one of the classic magical numbers of mankind. It's indivisible. It's a taboo number. You know, the dice players, 7 come 11, These are sacred numbers originally. They were taboo numbers. And seven is one of the classic ways of simply dividing time, dividing things. 3, 7, 11, and so on. In Israel, the seventh year was an important year because Jewish law established that the seventh year was to be a year of release. On the seventh year, any debt which was owed to you had to be forgiven. If the principal wasn't repaid, this debt was canceled. This was an early law designed to prevent the farmer who had very little capital from falling in debt to the city slicker, who came out at 11% interest and let him the grain for his crop for that year. If he couldn't repay at the end of the 7 years, the contract which established the debt became invalid. On the seventh year, the slave had to be set free. It was a year of release, and it therefore was an important year in the figuring. And since it was a year of release, and since it was a year in which debts were invalidated, it also became a year in which an agricultural practice was enshrined. The seventh year was the year in which the fields were not to be sown. They didn't know much about crop rotation, but they did know that you could abuse the land. And so what they said, that 1 year in seven, the land was to lie fallow. Whatever grew would simply be plowed back into the land. You couldn't plant a crop. This was a way of seeing to it that the land retained a certain fertility. And on that seventh year, people had plenty of time. So the seventh year was a good time for assembly, for meetings, for war, and for the reading of Torah. And that's how it all came about. No, it's perfectly right. It's perfectly right. What we used to do, though, is wrong. What we used to do is to say, it's a story, and we stop there. For two reasons. First of all, most of us were not quite sure we could explain evolution. And secondly, most of us tended to be self-conscious about the Bible. The Bible was old, it was archaic, it was bloodlusty. We took over all the preconceptions of the pseudo-scientific world, the cynical world, our Christian interpretations of the Bible, which, you know, made us remember. All Jews knew one line from the Bible, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. We didn't know where it was said, how it was qualified, but this is what the Christian world made us remember. Make people understand, that's what I've been trying to do here today, will do as we go on. What is involved in these stories, their beauty, their meaning, their place in the history of thought. And Judaism has its limitations, has its anachronisms, there's some ugly parts of the Bible. But by and large, the Bible stands up better than any other ancient document to our own modern critical standards. And that's what I'm trying to do, to make you understand these. Revelation is a basic tenet of Judaism, but Judaism insisted, if you mean Orthodox Judaism, traditionally, only on the revelation of the law. When an Orthodox boy, 100, 200 years ago, when any Jewish boy at that time was set to reading the Bible, you know where he began? Have any idea? He began with Leviticus 1. Now, Leviticus 1 is about as dry, uninteresting a part as you can possibly have. Has to do with temple rules and regulations and one thing or another. When any man of you bringeth an offering unto the Lord, ye shall bring your offering of the cattle, even of the herder of the flock. That's the first law in first sentence, really, of Leviticus, that you're supposed to bring sacrifices of beasts. Now, why did they begin there rather than with the stories of Genesis, which are much easier reading, better Hebrew to start off with, much more exciting to youngsters? Because the piety of Jewish life insisted on the authority, on the revealed authority of Jewish law, the so-called 613 commandments of the Bible. It never insisted on the same degree of revelation for these early myths and legends and tales. It saw a great meaning in them. An Orthodox person would say that these first chapters of the Bible must be read midrashically, which means this way, reading in and reading out, interpretively. I know none except the Telshi Yeshiva kind who would insist on a literal interpretation. And certainly Maimonides, Halevi, any of the great rabbis of the Middle Ages would not have insisted on the literal interpretation of these first chapters. This has never been a dogma of Jewish life, unlike that of Christian life. We insisted on the dogmatics of the law. That's our great difference with Christianity. We insist on discipline, on law, on rules and regulations. There are advantages and disadvantages. But that's what Sinai means to us. The Torah means law. The legendary parts, the historical parts, the quasi-historical parts we took as edifying, as instructive for the schoolroom and for the women. You know, they... let me give you an example. I don't mean to be masculine at the moment. But do any of you know what the Tzena Orena was? Tzena Orena was a Yiddish compilation of all the wonderful stories in the Talmud. And it was written for women. And Saturday afternoon, when your great-grandmothers were all left alone, while your great-grandfathers went to the shul to hear the rabbi talk about Jewish law, they were told, go read the Tzena Orena. This was all the instructive material about homely things and imaginative. It was wonderful. And this is why women have always, in Jewish life, have always been wonderful storytellers. They knew the stories far better than we men did. When you got down to serious business in the shul, you talked about the law, the parts of the Talmud which had been excised from the Tzena Orena, the practice, the day-to-day routines and regulations.